A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been looking at how cities actually get built and run, and he noticed something. There's a city manager, a city architect, sometimes a whole team of urban planners, and they're all supposedly working off this thing called a master plan. But what is a master plan, really? Is it a legal document, a vision statement, a zoning map, all of the above? And who are the people in these roles? What do they actually do day to day? What training do they bring? And how does any of this hold together when you cross a border or change the size of the city? It's a genuinely good question. Most of us live in cities and have no idea who's making the decisions that shape them.
It's one of those questions where the moment you start pulling on the thread, you realize how much variation there is. Let me start with the master plan, because that's the document that's supposed to tie everything together. At its core, a master plan, sometimes called a comprehensive plan or a general plan, is a city's long-range policy document. It's not a zoning code. That's the first thing most people get wrong. The zoning code is the legally binding rulebook that says what you can build where. The master plan is the vision that the zoning code is supposed to implement.
The master plan is the dream, and the zoning code is the bouncer at the door.
That's actually not a bad way to put it. The master plan says, we want a walkable mixed-use corridor connecting these two neighborhoods. The zoning code says whether you're allowed to build a coffee shop on that corner or whether it's single-family residential only. And here's the tension. In many American cities, the zoning code hasn't been updated to match the master plan for decades. So you get these beautifully illustrated plans showing tree-lined streets with corner cafes, and then the actual zoning still mandates parking minimums and bans anything but detached houses.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. The city sings about vibrancy and then zones for silence.
Now, what's actually in a master plan? Typically, it covers land use, housing, transportation, economic development, parks and open space, public facilities, and increasingly things like climate resilience and equity. It usually looks out 20 to 30 years. It's produced through a process that, ideally, involves extensive public engagement, data analysis, population projections, and then the Planning Commission and City Council adopt it. After adoption, it's supposed to be revisited every 5 to 10 years.
Supposed to be.
In practice, many cities let these things sit for 15 or 20 years. And here's a concrete number. The American Planning Association recommends updates every 10 years, but a survey a few years back found that something like a third of U.S. cities hadn't updated their comprehensive plan in over a decade. Some were working off plans from the 90s.
Of course they were. A plan from 1995 projecting out to 2025, still sitting on a shelf somewhere, probably next to a floppy disk.
The thing is, the master plan isn't just one document. It often includes a whole family of subplans. A bicycle master plan, a parks master plan, a historic preservation plan, a housing element. In California, the housing element is legally required to be updated every 8 years, and it has to demonstrate that the city has zoned enough land to accommodate its projected housing need. That's one of the few places where the master plan has real teeth.
Let me pull on that. How binding is a master plan? If the city council decides to approve a big development that contradicts the plan, does the plan have any legal force to stop it?
It depends enormously on the state and the country. In much of the United States, the master plan is advisory. It's a policy guide, not a law. The zoning code is the law. Some states have what's called the consistency doctrine. If you adopt a master plan, your zoning and land use decisions have to be consistent with it. Oregon is famous for this. Every Oregon city has to have a comprehensive plan, and all land use decisions have to align with it. But in many other states, the plan is essentially a suggestion. A developer can come in, ask for a rezoning that contradicts the plan, and the council can say yes.
Which makes the plan more of a political document than a technical one. It's a statement of what the current council would like to be seen supporting, with no guarantee the next council won't ignore it entirely.
And this is where the roles get interesting, because the city manager, the city architect, and the planning director all have different relationships to that political reality. Let me walk through them. The city manager, this is the chief executive of the city under the council manager form of government, which is the most common system in American cities above a certain size. The city manager is appointed by the city council, serves at their pleasure, and runs the day-to-day operations. They're not elected. They're a professional administrator.
This is the person who actually makes the trains run, or in most American cities, makes the buses run occasionally.
Make sure the trash gets picked up, the budget gets balanced, the departments function. The city manager typically has a master's in public administration, an MPA, or sometimes a background in business or engineering. They're generalists. Their job is to translate the council's policy direction into operational reality. When it comes to the master plan, the city manager doesn't write it. The planning department does. But the city manager is the one who has to figure out how to implement it within the budget, and they're often the one telling the council, you can adopt this plan, but it's going to cost you X million dollars in infrastructure, and I need to know where that's coming from.
The city manager is the one holding the calculator while the planners are holding the colored pencils.
Sometimes the calculator says no, which creates a natural tension. Now, the planning director. This is the person who runs the planning department and leads the master plan process. Their background is almost always in urban planning specifically. They'll have a master's in urban and regional planning, often from one of the big programs, MIT, Berkeley, Cornell, University of North Carolina. They might be certified by the American Institute of Certified Planners, which means they passed an exam and have professional experience. In the UK and Commonwealth countries, the equivalent is the Royal Town Planning Institute. In much of Europe, planning is a more specialized track within architecture or geography programs.
The planning director reports to the city manager?
The planning director is a department head, and the city manager is their boss. But here's where it gets nuanced. The planning director also has a direct line to the planning commission, which is an appointed board of citizens that reviews plans and makes recommendations to the council. So, the planning director serves two masters in some ways. They're implementing the council's vision through the city manager's chain of command, but they're also the professional staff to a citizen commission that can sometimes go in a very different direction.
That sounds like a recipe for getting caught in the middle. The commission wants a pedestrian paradise. The city manager has a pothole budget, and I'm supposed to make both of them happy.
Welcome to municipal planning. And then there's the city architect, which is a distinct role that doesn't exist in every city. It's more common in Europe, and in the US, it's more common in larger cities or cities with a strong design culture. The city architect is exactly what it sounds like, a licensed architect who works for the city. Their job is typically to oversee the design quality of public buildings and public spaces, and sometimes to review private development for design standards.
They're not planning the street grid. They're looking at whether the new library actually looks good and functions well.
And in some cities, the city architect has real power. In Barcelona, for example, the city architect's office has been central to the city's transformation since the 1980s. They set design guidelines, they run design competitions for public projects, and they coordinate infrastructure with public space in a way that's much more integrated than what you typically see in American cities. The Dutch have a similar tradition. Many Dutch cities have a city architect, or a team of them, embedded in the municipal structure with genuine authority over the quality of the built environment.
In the US?
More hit or miss. Some cities have a city architect, many don't. Where the role exists, it's often under the Public Works Department or the Planning Department. The city architect might review capital projects. Fire stations, community centers, city hall renovations. They might also serve on design review boards, but their power is usually more limited than their European counterparts. In the US, design review tends to happen through citizen boards, not through a single professional with clear authority.
Which explains a lot about the aesthetic quality of American public buildings. A committee of volunteers arguing about window treatments versus a trained architect making decisions.
I'd push back slightly. Citizen review can catch things that a single architect might miss, community preferences, local character, historical context. But you're right that it often leads to design by committee, which is the architectural equivalent of a gray minivan, safe, inoffensive, and utterly forgettable.
Build me a chair nobody notices they're sitting in. That's the brief.
Now, let me talk about how these roles interact, because this is where the organizational chart meets reality. In a well-functioning city, the planning department, led by the planning director, leads the master plan process. They hire consultants if needed, they run the public meetings, they draft the document. The city architect weighs in on the urban design and public realm sections. The city manager coordinates across departments, making sure the transportation people, the parks people, the public works people are all feeding into the plan. So it's not just a planning department fantasy. The city council adopts it. And then the hard part starts, implementation.
Which is where most master plans go to die.
Implementation is brutal. A master plan might call for a new transit corridor, but that requires capital funding, which requires a bond measure, which requires voter approval. It might call for higher density zoning, but that requires a zoning rewrite, which triggers neighborhood opposition, which triggers council members getting nervous. The planning director can recommend, the city architect can design, the city manager can budget, but ultimately the council has to vote, and if the council doesn't have the political will, the plan sits on the shelf.
Let's talk about variation. You mentioned Oregon's consistency requirement. How does this differ across countries?
It differs enormously. In the UK, the system is plan-led. The local plan, which is the British equivalent of the master plan, is the starting point for all planning decisions. If a developer proposes something that doesn't conform to the local plan, the presumption is against it. That's a much stronger legal position than in most of the US. In Germany, planning is highly codified. The Flecknutzungsplan, the land use plan, is prepared by the municipality and approved by higher levels of government. And then the Bebauungsplan, the binding land use plan, is legally enforceable. Germany also has a much stronger tradition of integrating transport planning with land use planning, which is why German cities tend to have better coordination between new development and transit access.
The Germans looked at the American system of planning transit after development and said, "What if we didn't do that?"
What a concept. In Japan, the system is even more different. Japanese cities have a zoning system, but it's set at the national level with 12 basic zone types, and local governments have relatively limited discretion to deviate. The national government also controls infrastructure investment much more directly. So the master plan in a Japanese city is less about controlling land use, because the zoning categories are nationally defined and more about coordinating infrastructure and setting a vision for growth areas. The Japanese system also makes it much easier to build housing by right. If your project fits the zone, you can build it. There's far less discretionary review than in the US.
Which is why Tokyo builds more housing than all of California, despite having a fraction of the land. The master plan sets the framework, and then it gets out of the way.
Tokyo built something like 140,000 housing units in 2023. The entire state of California built about 120,000. Tokyo is one city. California is 40 million people. The difference in planning philosophy is enormous.
The master plan in Japan is scaffolding, not a straitjacket. In the US, it's often a straitjacket that nobody's actually wearing. It's just hanging in the closet while everyone does whatever they want through variances and spot rezonings.
The variance system in the US is a whole separate conversation, but you're right. It often undermines the master plan entirely. A developer proposes something that doesn't conform to the plan. They ask for a variance or a rezoning, and if they have enough political support, they get it. The plan becomes a suggestion that gets overridden constantly. At that point, what's the plan even doing?
It's doing public relations. It lets the city say, "We have a vision," without actually committing to anything.
Let me talk about city size, because this was part of the question, and it matters enormously. In a small city, say 30,000 people, you might not have a separate planning director at all. The city manager might wear that hat, or there might be a community development director who handles planning, building permits, and economic development all in one role. You almost certainly won't have a city architect. The master plan might be done entirely by consultants because the in-house expertise doesn't exist. And the plan itself might be relatively simple. Here's where we want growth, here's where we want to preserve open space, here's the downtown we'd like to revitalize.
In a city of a million?
A large city will have a planning department with dozens or hundreds of staff, specialized divisions for long-range planning, current planning, urban design, historic preservation, environmental review. The planning director is a senior executive who might be one of the most powerful unelected officials in the city. The city architect, if the city has one, might lead a design studio within the planning department or public works. The city manager, or in a strong mayor system, the mayor's office, coordinates across all of this. And the master plan in a large city is a massive undertaking. We're talking years of work, millions of dollars in consultant contracts, thousands of public comments, an environmental impact report that runs to hundreds of pages.
At which point, the master plan is less a document and more a small industry.
That's a real critique. Some planners argue that master plans have become too elaborate, too expensive, and too slow to respond to changing conditions. By the time you finish a 5-year planning process, the city has changed. The housing market has shifted, the economy has shifted, and you're adopting a plan that's already out of date. There's a movement toward what's called incremental planning or adaptive planning. Shorter documents, more frequent updates, more flexibility.
The Agile Manifesto reaches City Hall.
Some cities are moving toward 2-year planning cycles instead of 10-year ones, with digital plans that can be updated continuously rather than printed documents that sit on shelves. But that requires a level of staff capacity and data infrastructure that most cities don't have.
Let me ask about the planning profession itself. You mentioned the AICP certification. What does the pipeline into these roles actually look like? Who becomes a planning director?
The typical path in the U.S. is a master's degree in urban planning. 2 years covering land use law, planning theory, GIS, statistics, public participation, transportation planning, housing policy. Then you work as a planner for a city or a consulting firm for several years, and eventually you get your AICP if you want the credential. From there, you might become a senior planner, then a planning manager, then a planning director. The whole progression might take 15 to 20 years. Planning directors in large cities are often recruited nationally. It's a competitive field with a fairly small pool of experienced people.
The city manager track is different?
City managers often come up through the administrative side. They might start in the budget office, or as an assistant city manager, or in public works. The MPA is the standard degree, not the planning degree. City managers are generalist executives. They're expected to manage a police department, a fire department, a parks department, a planning department, all of them. Their skill is organizational leadership and political navigation, not land use expertise. A good city manager knows enough about planning to ask the right questions, but they're relying on the planning director for the technical substance.
The city architect is a completely different pipeline again. Architecture school, licensure, years of practice, and then a move into the public sector, probably taking a pay cut to do work they believe in.
The pay cut is real. A mid-career architect at a private firm can make substantially more than a city architect. The people who take those roles tend to be motivated by the scale of impact. You can shape a whole city's public realm in a way that you never could in private practice. But the trade-off is bureaucracy, slower timelines, and less creative control than you'd have designing a single building for a private client.
The urban planner's version of, I could have made more money, but I wanted to do something that mattered.
That's the pitch anyway. Sometimes it's even true. Let me circle back to international variation because there's one more dimension I want to touch on. In many European countries, the planning profession is much more tightly integrated with architecture. In France, for example, the state employs architects and urban planners through a system called the Architectes et Urbanistes de l'État, state architects and urbanists who work in regional planning agencies and have significant authority. In the Netherlands, planning is deeply tied to water management and infrastructure engineering because so much of the country is below sea level. The Dutch planning tradition is legendary. They've been doing comprehensive spatial planning at the national level since the 1960s, and their plans are remarkably detailed and legally binding.
The Dutch had to get good at planning because the alternative was drowning. That focuses the mind.
Nothing concentrates the planning mind like the North Sea. And the Dutch system has produced some of the best urbanism in the world. Not just Amsterdam's canal belt, which is historic, but the modern expansions, the new towns, the integrated bicycle networks. All of that comes from a planning culture that takes the master plan seriously as a binding document, not a suggestion.
What are the common failure modes? If you were diagnosing a dysfunctional planning system, what would you look for?
I'd look for a few things. 1, the master plan and the zoning code saying completely different things. That's the classic sign that the plan is window dressing. 2, A planning department that's understaffed and overwhelmed, so they can't do proactive planning and just react to development applications. 3. A city council that uses the master plan as a political prop, but ignores it whenever a controversial project comes up. 4. A planning commission that's stacked with people who have a very specific agenda, usually either never build anything or build anything anywhere, rather than a balanced group trying to implement the plan.
The NIMBY to YIMBY spectrum, with the plan as the rope in a tug of war.
The rope usually breaks. The fifth failure mode, and this one is more subtle, is a master plan that's too vague to be useful. If the plan says, encourage vibrant mixed-use neighborhoods, without specifying where, at what densities, with what infrastructure, and with what zoning changes, it's not a plan. It's a mood board.
The master plan as aspirational Pinterest board. We like brick. We like trees. We like community. And then nothing happens.
A good master plan is specific. It says, we will upzone this corridor to allow 4-story mixed-use buildings. We will invest in a new bus rapid transit line here. We will acquire these 3 parcels for a new park, and we will adopt a design overlay for the historic district. That's a plan you can implement, measure, and hold people accountable to.
That kind of specificity is politically harder because it gives opponents something concrete to fight. A vague plan passes unanimously and achieves nothing.
Which is why the best master plans are often the ones that come out of a crisis or a strong political mandate. After a natural disaster, a city might do a comprehensive replanning because the old system literally doesn't exist anymore. Or a mayor might run and win on a specific planning platform and have the political capital to push it through. Routine, business as usual master plan updates rarely produce transformative results.
The planning equivalent of never let a good crisis go to waste.
I'd phrase it more charitably, but yes. Let me talk briefly about one more role that's adjacent to all of this, the planning consultant. Because in many cities, especially smaller ones, the master plan isn't produced by in-house staff at all. It's produced by a consulting firm. Firms like MIG, AECOM, or smaller regional firms. The city issues an RFP, consultants bid on it, and the winner runs the whole process. Public engagement, data analysis, plan drafting, everything.
Which creates a weird dynamic where the people who actually know the plan best are external contractors who leave when the project is done.
That's a real problem for implementation. The consultants deliver a beautiful document, the council adopts it, and then the in-house staff, who may not have been deeply involved in creating it, are supposed to implement it. There's a knowledge transfer gap. Some cities are getting smarter about this by having planning staff embedded in the consultant team, but it's still a structural challenge.
We've got a city manager running the show, a planning director writing the vision, a city architect minding the design quality, a council providing political cover or political interference depending on the day, and possibly a team of consultants who actually did most of the work. And all of this varies wildly depending on whether you're in Portland, Oregon, or Portland, Maine, or Portland, Dorset.
Portland, Dorset, is going to have a completely different system because it's in the UK, where the local plan is legally binding. The planning officers are part of the district council, and there's a national planning policy framework that sets the rules from Westminster. The basic functions are similar. Someone has to plan, someone has to manage, someone has to review design. But the institutional architecture is completely different.
It's almost like cities are complicated.
They're the most complicated human invention short of a language, and we've barely scratched the surface of how these roles interact in practice. The planning director and the city manager might be allies or rivals. The city architect might be empowered or marginalized. The master plan might be a living document or a dead letter. It all comes down to the specific people, the specific politics, and the specific legal framework of each city.
If a listener is sitting in their city and wondering why their built environment looks the way it does, the answer is probably buried in a document they've never read, produced by people they've never heard of, through a process they didn't know existed.
That document might be brilliant or useless, and the people might be visionary or checked out, and the process might be inclusive or completely captured. But understanding the roles is the first step to understanding why your city works or doesn't.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 14th century, the Mali Empire maintained a royal court so elaborate that a single surviving manuscript from a North African traveler describes the manse's throne room as having silk curtains, a gold-embroidered dome, and an official whose sole job was to relay the emperor's words through an intermediary because no petitioner was permitted to address the Mansa directly.
The relay official. A whole career built on being a human telephone.
Honestly, that's not far from what a city manager does between the council and the departments.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtoft, for keeping this operation running. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps people find the show. We'll be back soon.
See you then.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.